You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
A New Zealand academic says the government has worsened conditions on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island by quarantining Melanesia. More than 700 asylum seekers remain on Manus, where they have been detained in Australian-run centres since 2012. Reports have surfaced of men from the centres being abused and attacked with machetes by the local Manus community. But Scott Hamilton, a Pacific author and academic, says these problems must be contextualised within New Zealand and Australia's neglect of the region.
It's interesting to just reflect on the parts of the subject that haven't been treated in the mainstream media, and there's just been a, I think, quite frustrating failure to contextualise the refugee crisis on Manus Island, because this is going on in the midst of a Melanesian society and an island, an offshore island of Papua New Guinea, which is a very complex and also very a nation that's in turmoil at the moment. And we've had this quite vociferous debate between the different sides about the fate of the refugees on Manus Island, but in many ways we can't completely understand their situation without understanding the political context. There is a very unpopular government in Papua New Guinea, which has been accused by many people of recently stealing an election, using all sorts of illegitimate tactics. This government is being bankrolled by Australia and supported implicitly by New Zealand. And the whole election process, which has just played out in Papua New Guinea, has been vociferously criticised by numerous observers, but it's been supported by Australia and New Zealand. So we have this government in place in Papua New Guinea, which is deeply unpopular, resented by the regions of Papua New Guinea, including the Manus Island region, and which is absolutely dedicated to working in this almost unwholesome sort of closeness with Australia in terms of implementing your refugee policies. And it's very difficult not to conclude that the government of Peter O'Neill in Papua New Guinea is in power partly because of its willingness to play along with Australia's quite hard-line policy on refugees. So unless we understand that context, we're in danger of really ignoring what's going on over there. And there's been a sort of a demonisation, a disappointing demonisation. When they have been mentioned, the Papuan people have been demonised. They've been presented as these dark-skinned savages who are likely to descend upon the Manus refugees if the dubious protection of the Australian security forces is lifted. And there have even been cartoons appearing in the Australian media showing them as cannibals or showing them waving machetes. They are presented almost as another of the hardships which the refugees have had to endure. So not only do they have the oppressive climate, the poor conditions, the lack of educational facilities, health facilities, they also have this dark and menacing indigenous population all around them. And I think that's a very unjust characterisation of the way that the Manus people have behaved towards the refugees. As some commentators have noticed in the last couple of weeks during the crisis, most of the food the refugees have received has come from islanders.
Yeah, and it's not just the resentment of the local community that has perhaps been overplayed by the media and, political heads, but it's also, you're saying that this resentment is kind of fostered by these conditions under Papua New Guinea's government, which, New Zealand and Australia are to some degree responsible for as kind of aid partners.
Yes, there's a very legitimate anger in the regions of Papua New Guinea at the failure of the government to provide development, and at the there's an accurate perception that decisions are made far away in Port Moresby, and that the local regions have very little say in those decisions, but have to live with the outcomes of those decisions. And so it is a legitimate complaint for the people of Manus Island to say, we weren't consulted properly about this refugee resettlement scheme. We didn't have a voice, and it has been a tremendous disruption to their society, having this large number of refugees in their midst, having Australian contractors. It's been a disruption to their way of life, and there have been all sorts of difficulties. After the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court allowed the refugees to out of detention and allowed them to sort of roam the island, there were a number of incidents and cultural misunderstandings. There have been a couple of reports of rape. There have been a whole series of interactions with refugees who've been in this extraordinary pressure cooker of this, this very, very difficult environment that the Australians have created for asylum seekers, and who are now suffering from very severe mental illnesses. And there's no possibility of treating them on Manus Island. And some of these very damaged asylum seekers, have been very, very difficult for the Manus community to host and to support. So I think that even when the Manus Islanders have been complaining about the impact of refugees on the island, I think they do have some legitimate grounds for complaint, because they weren't consulted and they haven't been given the resources with which they can really host these people.
There have been calls on New Zealand and obviously Australia too to take all of the refugees from Manus Island, but you've also made the case for kind of opening up migration to New Zealand from Melanesia, Papua New Guinea included, which I guess this is different from, say, a refugee cause, but why do you think there's a need for that?
Well, I think in New Zealand we have a history of giving a lot of attention to political crises and geopolitical crises on the other side of the world, distant parts of the world, and not perhaps giving the attention we should be giving to our own backyard. And without at all wanting to detract from the case that has been made for taking the Manus Island asylum seekers to New Zealand, I think a very compelling case can be made that the people of Melanesia are themselves suffering a sort of quarantine. Deborah McDougall, an Australian academic, has done a very interesting study on migration in Melanesia. She's talking about the Melanesian nations of Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, and Vanuatu. And she discovered that these countries have the lowest migration rate in the world, 0.2% in Papua New Guinea. So one in every 500 Papuans will get to migrate. And at the same time, these countries have exploding populations, and they have urbanisation, domestic urbanisation. So people are flocking to the cities, to Port Moresby, to Honiara, to Port Vila. And you have this tremendous pressure on infrastructure and resources. And if we look historically at the development of societies, not only in the Pacific, but in the Northern Hemisphere, migration and the ability to form migrant communities have been absolutely vital to the economies of these countries. I mean, imagine the Irish without their history of migration and their ability to establish beachheads in wealthier parts of the world, to establish thriving communities, to gain access to jobs there and to send remittances home. And in our own part of the world, Tonga and Samoa, many Polynesian countries, many Micronesian societies like the Marshall Islands have been able to send a good proportion of their population abroad, and this has had tremendous economic benefits. When people migrate from these societies, they're not abandoning these societies, they're not rejecting them, they're not turning their backs on them. They're simply accessing educational resources and jobs and wealth which they can't get at home, and they transfer a lot of their wealth home, and they eventually a lot of them return and they transfer their skills, and it has been a tremendous boon to these societies. And there's the remittances and there's the wealth that they send home. There's also the effect of relieving pressure. You don't have this tremendous problem which you have in Melanesia, which is large numbers of young people living in the cities. They've come from their villages. They can't go home. There's no land for them at home. They've lost, in many ways, the ability to work their land and a lot of traditional knowledge, and they're trapped in the city. And they, you know, there's a phrase that Brit McDougall uses when she discusses Honiara, the capital of the Solomons. She said, in the Solomons, all roads lead to Honiara, and they end there in an enormous traffic jam. And there's a human tragedy that anyone can see visiting these cities. You know, Port Vila, where I was last year, you see the most extraordinary juxtapositions. You see these luxury cruise ships coming in. You see this eight-story casino on the waterfront. And then you see these shanty towns and these young, energetic, ambitious people who are unable to, you know, realize all their potential because the path to migration is barred. The one exception to this sort of quarantining of the region by Australia and New Zealand is the recognised seasonal employer scheme, which was enacted in 2007, so it's 10 years old. And this is a scheme, interestingly enough, it was developed by New Zealand First. It's a scheme which allows a temporary migration. You can come to New Zealand, you can work for 3 or 6 months, often in places like vineyards, orchards, and particularly in the regions where there's a labour shortage. And there have been tens of thousands of people who've come from both Melanesia and Polynesia and even parts of Micronesia to New Zealand under the RSE, the Recognised Seasonal Employer Scheme. And they, you know, I've talked to numerous families and villages in Polynesia and Melanesia, and this scheme has had tremendously beneficial effects. People are able to come home having saved some money, having worked here. They're able to build houses. They're able to open shops. They're able to pay for their children's education. There are some problems with the scheme. They're not paid particularly well. They're paid slightly less than the minimum wage. They don't have access to public health care. So there are various things that could be improved. But the scheme overall has had a tremendously positive impact. The tragedy is that people, having come here, having worked hard, having contributed to the New Zealand economy, having learnt something of New Zealand culture, having begun to establish a sort of a beachhead here, are forced to return home. And you sometimes have people who are coming here every year, for year after year, and they're never given the opportunity to remain. And it just seems to me that there will be tremendous benefits to the whole region if New Zealand and Australia were more open to migration from Melanesia. And we've seen a sort of series of crises in the Melanesian countries over the last two decades. Civil war in the Solomons from 1998 to 2003, ongoing unrest in Papua New Guinea, and the recent violent election, the prospect of renewed war on Bougainville Island, problems as well on a smaller scale in Vanuatu. And these problems, as one of their causes, I think they have as one of their causes the absolute failure of the rest of the world to open its doors to young and ambitious Melanesians, and the very large numbers of frustrated young people who are congregating in the cities of Melanesia and who are angry and whose energies can be, you know, sometimes are channeled in the wrong direction.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.